premiums on the absolute Littimer as a most respectable fellow and thoroughly admirable servant. Mr. McCorbell, I may remark, had taken his full share of the general bow, and had received it with infinite condescension. But punch, my dear Copperfield, said Mr. McCorbell, tasting it, like time and tide waits for no man. Ah! It is at the present moment in high flavour. My love, will you give me your opinion? Mrs. McCorbell pronounced it excellent. Then, I will drink, said Mr. McCorbell, if my friend Copperfield will permit me to take that social liberty, to the days when my friend Copperfield and myself were younger and fought our way in the world side by side. I may say of myself and Copperfield in words we have sung together before now that we twa hae run about the braes and pooed the gowans fine. In a figurative point of view, on several occasions. I'm not exactly aware, said Mr. Micawber with the old roll in his voice and the old indescribable air of saying something genteel, what gowans may be, but I have no doubt that Copperfield and myself would frequently have taken a pull at them if it had been feasible. Mr. Micawber, at the then-present moment, took a pull at his punch. So we all did. Traddles, evidently lost in wondering at what distant time Mr. Micawber and I could possibly have been comrades in the battle of the world. Said Mr. Micawber, clearing his throat and warming with the punch and with the fire. My dear, another glass? Mrs. Micawber said it must be very little, but we couldn't allow that, so it was a glassful. As we are quite confidential here, Mr. Copperfield, said Mrs. Micawber, sipping her punch, Mr. Traddles being a part of our domesticity, I should much like to have your opinion on Mr. Micawber's prospects. For corn, said Mrs. Micawber argumentatively, as I have repeatedly said to Mr. Micawber, may be gentlemanly, but it is not remunerative. Commission to the extent of 2 and 9 pence in a fortnight cannot, however limited our ideas, be considered remunerative. We were all agreed upon that. Then, said Mrs. Micawber, who prided herself on taking a clear view of things, and keeping Mr. Micawber straight by her woman's wisdom when he might otherwise go a little crooked, then I ask myself this question. If corn is not to be relied upon, what is? Are coals to be relied upon? Not at all. We have turned our attention to that experiment on the suggestion of my family, and we find it fallacious. Mr. Micawber, leaning back in his chair with his hands in his pockets, eyed us aside and nodded his head as much as to say that the case was very clearly put. The articles of corn and coals, said Mrs. Micawber, still more argumentatively, being equally out of the question, Mr. Copperfield, I naturally look round the world and say, what is there in which a person of Mr. Micawber's talent is likely to succeed? And I exclude the doing anything on commission, because commission is not a certainty. What is best suited to a person of Mr. Micawber's peculiar temperament is, I am convinced, a certainty. Traddles and I both expressed by a feeling murmur that this great discovery was no doubt true of Mr. Micawber, and that it did him much credit. I will not conceal from you, my dear Mr. Copperfield, said Mrs. Micawber, that I have long felt the brewing business to be particularly adapted to Mr. Micawber. Look at Barclay and Perkins. Look at Truman, Hanbury and Buxton. It is on that extensive footing that Mr. Micawber, I know from my own knowledge of him, is calculated to shine. And the profits, I am told, are enormous. But if Mr. Micawber cannot get into those firms which decline to answer his letters when he offers his services even in an inferior capacity, what is the use of dwelling upon that idea? None. I may have a conviction that Mr. Micawber's manners... Really, my dear, interposed Mr. Micawber, my love, be silent. said Mrs. Micawber, laying her brown glove on his hand. "I may have a conviction, Mr. Copperfield, that Mr. Micawber's manners peculiarly qualify him for the banking business. I may argue within myself that if I had a deposit at a banking house, the manners of Mr. Micawber as representing that banking house would inspire confidence and must extend the connection. But if the various banking houses refuse to avail themselves of Mr. Micawber's abilities, or receive the offer of them with contumely, what is the use of dwelling upon that idea? None! As to originating a banking business, I may know that there are members of my family who, if they chose to place their money in Mr. Micawber's hands, might found an establishment of that description. But if they do not choose to place their money in Mr. Micawber's hands, which they don't, what is the use of that? Again, I contend that we are no farther advanced than we were before. I shook my head and said not a bit. Traddles also shook his head and said not a bit. What do I deduce from this? Mrs. Micawber went on to say, still with the same air of putting a case lucidly. What is the conclusion, my dear Mr. Copperfield, to which I am irresistibly brought? Am I wrong in saying it is clear that we must live? I answered not at all. And Traddles answered not at all. And I found myself afterwards sagely adding alone that a person must either live or die. Just so, returned Mrs. Micawber. It is precisely that. And the fact is, my dear Mr. Copperfield, that we cannot live without something widely different from existing circumstances shortly turning up. Now, I'm convinced myself, and this I have pointed out to Mr. Micawber several times of late, that things cannot be expected to turn up of themselves. We must, in a measure, assist to turn them up. I may be wrong, but I have formed that opinion. Both Traddles and I applauded it highly. Very well, said Mrs. Micawber. Then what do I recommend? Here is Mr. Micawber, with a variety of qualifications, with great talent. Really, my love, said Mr. Micawber. Pray, my dear, allow me to conclude. Here is Mr. Micawber, with a variety of qualifications, with great talent. I should say with genius, but that may be the partiality of a wife. Traddles and I both murmured no. And here is Mr. Micawber, without any suitable position or employment. Where does that responsibility rest? Clearly on society. Then I would make a fact so disgraceful known and boldly challenge society to set it right. It appears to me, my dear Mr. Copperfield, said Mrs. Micawber forcibly, that what Mr. Micawber has to do is to throw down the gauntlet to society and say in effect, show me who will take that up. Let the party immediately step forward. I ventured to ask Mrs. Micawber how this was to be done. By advertising, said Mrs. Micawber, in all the papers. It appears to me that what Mr. Micawber has to do, in justice to himself, in justice to his family, and I will even go so far as to say in justice to society, by which he has been hitherto overlooked, is to advertise in all the papers, to describe himself plainly as so-and-so, with such-and-such qualifications, and to put it thus now. Employ me on remunerative terms and address postpaid to W.M. Post Office, Camden Town. This idea of Mrs. Micawber's, my dear Copperfield, said Mr. Micawber, making his shirt collar meet in front of his chin and glancing at me sideways, is, in fact, the leap to which I alluded when I last had the pleasure of seeing you. Advertising's rather expensive, I remarked dubiously. Exactly so, said Mrs. Micawber, preserving the same logical air. Quite true, my dear Mr. Copperfield. I have made the identical observation to Mr. Micawber. It is for that reason especially that I think Mr. Micawber ought, as I have already said, injustice to himself, injustice to his family, and injustice to society, to raise a certain sum of money on a bill. Mr. Micawber, leaning back in his chair, trifled with his eyeglass, and cast his eyes up at the ceiling. But I thought him observant of Traddles, too, who was looking at the fire. "If no member of my family," said Mrs. Micawber, "is possessed of sufficient natural feeling to negotiate that bill," I believe there is a better business term to express what I mean. Mr. Micawber, with his eyes still cast up at the ceiling, suggested discount. "To discount that bill," said Mrs. Micawber. "Then my opinion is that Mr. Micawber should go into the city, should take that bill into the money market, and should dispose of it for what he can get. If the individuals in the money market oblige Mr. Micawber to sustain a great sacrifice, that is between themselves and their consciences. I view it steadily as an investment. I recommend Mr. Micawber, my dear Mr. Copperfield, to do the same, to regard it as an investment which is to secure a return and to make up his mind to any sacrifice." I felt, but I'm sure I don't know why, that this was self-denying and devoted in Mrs. Micawber, and I uttered a murmur to that effect. Traddles, who took his tone from me, did likewise, still looking at the fire. "I will not," said Mrs. Micawber, finishing her punch and gathering her scarf about her shoulders, preparatory to her withdrawal to my bedroom, "I will not protract these remarks on the subject of Mr. Micawber's pecuniary affairs. At your fireside, my dear Mr. Copperfield, and in the presence of Mr. Traddles, who, though not so old a friend, is quite one of ourselves, I could not refrain from making you acquainted with the course I advise Mr. Micawber to take. I feel that the time is arrived when Mr. Micawber should exert himself, and, I will add, assert himself, and it appears to me that these are the means. I am aware that I am merely a female, and that a masculine judgment is usually considered more competent to the discussion of such questions. Still, I must not forget that when I lived at home with my papa and mamma, my papa was in the habit of saying, 'Emma's form is fragile, but her grasp of a subject is inferior to none.' That my papa was too partial, I well know, but that he was an observer of character in some degree, my duty and my reason equally forbid me to doubt." With these words, and resisting our entreaties that she would grace the remaining circulation of the punch with her presence, Mrs. Micawber retired to my bedroom. And really I felt that she was a noble woman, the sort of woman who might have been a Roman matron and done all manner of heroic things in times of public trouble. In the fervour of this impression, I congratulated Mr. Micawber on the treasure he possessed. So did Traddles. Mr. Micawber extended his hand to each of us in succession, and then covered his face with his pocket handkerchief, which I think had more snuff upon it than he was aware of. He then returned to the punch in the highest state of exhilaration. He was full of eloquence. He gave us to understand that in our children we lived again, and that under the pressure of pecuniary difficulties any accession to their number was doubly welcome. He said that Mrs. Micawber had latterly had her doubts on this point, but that he had dispelled them and reassured her. As to her family, they were wholly unworthy of her, and their sentiments were utterly indifferent to him, and they might, I quote his own expression, go to the devil. Mr. Micawber then delivered a warm eulogy on Traddles. He said Traddles was a character to the steady virtues of which he, Mr. Micawber, could lay no claim, but which, he thanked heaven, he could admire. He feelingly alluded to the young lady unknown whom Traddles had honoured with his affection, and who had reciprocated that affection by honouring and blessing Traddles with her affection. Mr. Micawber pledged her, so did I. Traddles thanked us both by saying, with a simplicity and honesty I had sense enough to be quite charmed with, "I am very much obliged to you indeed, and I do assure you she's the dearest girl." Mr. Micawber took an early opportunity after that of hinting, with the utmost delicacy and ceremony, at the state of my affections. Nothing but the serious assurance of his friend Copperfield to the contrary, he observed, could deprive him of the impression that his friend Copperfield loved and was beloved. After feeling very hot and uncomfortable for some time, and after a good deal of blushing, stammering and denying, I said, having my glass in my hand, "Well, I would give them D," which so excited and gratified Mr. Micawber that he ran with a glass of punch into my bedroom in order that Mrs. Micawber might drink D, who drank it with enthusiasm, crying from within in a shrill voice, "Hear, hear, my dear Mr. Copperfield, I am delighted! Hear!" and tapping at the wall by way of applause. Our conversation afterwards took a more worldly turn, Mr. Micawber telling us that he found Camden Town inconvenient, and that the first thing he contemplated doing when the advertisement should have been the cause of something satisfactory turning up was to move. He mentioned a terrace at the western end of Oxford Street, fronting Hyde Park, on which he had always had his eye, but which he did not expect to attain immediately, as it would require a large establishment. There would probably be an interval, he explained, in which he should content himself with the upper part of a house, over some respectable place of business, say in Piccadilly, which would be a cheerful situation for Mrs. Micawber, and whereby throwing out a bow window, or carrying up the roof another story, or making some little alteration of that sort, they might live comfortably and reputably for a few years. Whatever was reserved for him, he expressly said, or wherever his abode might be, we might rely on this. There would always be a room for Traddles and a knife and fork for me. We acknowledged his kindness, and he begged us to forgive his having launched into these practical and business-like details, and to excuse it as natural in one who is making entirely new arrangements in life. Mrs. Micawber, tapping at the wall again to know if tea were ready, broke up this particular phase of our friendly conversation. She made tea for us in a most agreeable manner, and whenever I went near her in handing about the teacups and bread and butter, asked me in a whisper whether D was fair or dark, or whether she was short or tall, or something of that kind, which I think I liked. After tea we discussed a variety of topics before the fire, and Mrs. Micawber was good enough to sing us, in a small, thin, flat voice, which I remember to have considered when I first knew her the very table beer of acoustics, the favourite ballads of the Dashing White Sergeant and Little Taflin. For both of these songs, Mrs. Micawber had been famous when she lived at home with her papa and mamma. And Mr. Micawber told us that when he heard her sing the first one, on the first occasion of his seeing her beneath the parental roof, she had attracted his attention in an extraordinary degree, but that when it came to Little Taflin, he had resolved to win that woman or perish in the attempt. It was between 10 and 11 o'clock when Mrs. Micawber rose to replace her cap in the whitey-brown paper parcel and to put on her bonnet. Mr. Micawber took the opportunity of Traddles putting on his greatcoat to slip a letter into my hand with a whispered request that I would read it at my leisure. I also took the opportunity of my holding a candle over the banisters to light them down when Mr. Micawber was going first, leading Mrs. Micawber, and Traddles was following with the cap, to detain Traddles for a moment on the top of the stairs. "Traddles," said I, "Mr. Micawber don't mean any harm, poor fellow, but if I were you I wouldn't lend him anything." "My dear Copperfield," returned Traddles, smiling, "I haven't got anything to lend."
"You have got a name, you know," said I.
"Oh, you call that something to lend?" returned Traddles with a thoughtful look. "Certainly." "Oh," said Traddles, "yes, to be sure. I am very much obliged to you, Copperfield, but I'm afraid I've lent him that already."
"For the bill that is to be a certain investment?" I inquired.
"No," said Traddles, "not for that one. This is the first I've heard of that one. I've been thinking that he will most likely propose that one on the way home. Mine's another."
"I hope there'll be nothing wrong about it," said I.
"I hope not," said Traddles. "I should think not, though, because he told me only the other day that it was provided for." That was Mr. Micawber's expression, "provided for." Mr. Micawber looking up at this juncture to where we were standing, I had only time to repeat my caution. Traddles thanked me and descended. But I was much afraid when I observed the good-natured manner in which he went down with the cap in his hand and gave Mrs. Micawber his arm, that he would be carried into the money market neck and heels. I returned to my fireside and was musing half gravely and half laughing on the character of Mr. Micawber and the old relations between us when I heard a quick step ascending the stairs. At first I thought it was Traddles coming back with something Mrs. Micawber had left behind. But as the step approached, I knew it, and felt my heart beat high, and the blood rush to my face, for it was Steerforth's. I was never unmindful of Agnes, and she never left that sanctuary in my thoughts, if I may call it so, where I had placed her from the first. But when he entered, and stood before me with his hand out, the darkness that had fallen on him changed to light, and I felt confounded and ashamed of having doubted one I loved so heartily. I loved her none the less. I thought of her as the same benignant, gentle angel in my life. I reproached myself, not her, with having done him an injury, and I would have made him any atonement if I'd known what to make and how to make it. "Why, Daisy, old boy, dumbfounded!" laughed Steerforth, shaking my hand heartily and throwing it gaily away. "Have I detected you in another feast, you sybarite? These Doctors Commons fellows are the gayest men in town, I believe, and beat us sober Oxford people all to nothing." His bright glance went merrily round the room as he took the seat on the sofa opposite to me, which Mrs. Micawber had recently vacated, and stirred the fire into a blaze. "I was so surprised at first," said I, giving him welcome with all the cordiality I felt, "that I'd hardly breath to greet you with, Steerforth." "Well, the sight of me is good for sore eyes, as the Scotch say," replied Steerforth, "and so is the sight of you, Daisy, in full bloom. How are you, my bacchanal?" I'm very well," said I. "I'm not at all bacchanalian tonight, though I confess to another party of three, all of whom I met in the street talking loud in your praise," returned Steerforth. "Who's our friend in the tights?" I gave him the best idea I could in a few words of Mr. Micawber. He laughed heartily at my feeble portrait of that gentleman, and said he was a man to know, and he must know him. "But who do you suppose our other friend is?" said I, in my turn. "Heaven knows," said Steerforth. "Not a bore, I hope. I thought he looked a little like one." "Traddles," I replied triumphantly. "Who's he?" asked Steerforth in his careless way. "Don't you remember Traddles? Traddles in our room at Salem House?" "Oh, that fellow," said Steerforth, beating a lump of coal on the top of the fire with the poker. "Is he as soft as ever? And where the deuce did you pick him up?" I extolled Traddles in reply as highly as I could, for I felt that Steerforth rather slighted him. Steerforth, dismissing the subject with a light nod and a smile, and the remark that he would be glad to see the old fellow too, for he'd always been an odd fish, inquired if I could give him anything to eat. During most of this short dialogue, when he'd not been speaking in a wild, vivacious manner, he had sat idly beating on the lump of coal with the poker. I observed that he did the same thing while I was getting out the remains of the pigeon pie and so forth. "Why, Daisy, here's a supper for a king!" he exclaimed, starting out of his silence with a burst and taking his seat at the table. "I shall do it justice, for I've come from Yarmouth." "I thought you came from Oxford," I returned. "Not I," said Steerforth. "I've been seafaring. Better employed." "Littimer was here today to inquire for you," I remarked, "and I understood him that you were at Oxford. Though now I think of it, he certainly didn't say so." "Littimer's a greater fool than I thought him to have been inquiring for me at all," said Steerforth, jovially pouring out a glass of wine and drinking to me. "As to understanding him, you're a cleverer fellow than most of us, Daisy, if you can do that." "That's true indeed," said I, moving my chair to the table. "So you've been at Yarmouth, Steerforth?" "Interested to know all about it. Have you been there long?" "No," he returned. "An escapade of a week or so." "And how are they all? Of course, little Emily's not married yet." "Not yet. Going to be, I believe, in so many weeks or months or something or other. I've not seen much of them."
This ends side one of cassette 14. Please turn the cassette over and start side two at the same point.
By the by... He laid down his knife and fork, which he'd been using with great diligence, and began feeding in his pockets. I have a letter for you. From whom? Why, from your old nurse, he returned, taking some papers out of his breast pocket. J. Steerforth, Esquire, debtor to the willing mind. That's not it. Patience, and we'll find it presently. Old Watsy's name's in a bad way, and it's about that, I believe. Barkist, you mean? Yes. Still feeling in his pockets and looking over their contents. It's all over with poor Barkis, I'm afraid. I saw a little apothecary there, surgeon or whatever he is, who brought your worship into the world. He was mighty learned about the case to me, but the upshot of his opinion was that the carrier was making his last journey rather fast. Put your hand into the breast pocket of my greatcoat on the chair yonder, and I think you'll find the letter. Is it there? Here it is, said I. That's right. It was from Peggotty. Something less legible than usual and brief. It informed me of her husband's hopeless state, and hinted at his being a little nearer than heretofore, and consequently more difficult to manage for his own comfort. It said nothing of her weariness and watching, and praised him highly. It was written with a plain, unaffected, homely piety that I knew to be genuine, and ended with, my duty to my ever-darling, meaning myself. While I deciphered it, Steerforth continued to eat and drink. It's a bad job, he said when I'd done, but the sun sets every day and people die every minute, and we mustn't be scared by the common lot. If we failed to hold our own because that equal-footed all men's doors was heard knocking somewhere, every object in this world would slip from us. No, ride on, rough-shod if need be, smooth-shod if that'll do, but ride on, ride over all obstacles and win the race. And win what race? Said I. The race that one has started in, said he. Ride on! I noticed, I remember, as he paused, looking at me with his handsome head a little thrown back, and his glass raised in his hand, that though the freshness of the sea wind was on his face, and it was ruddy, there were traces in it, made since I last saw it, as if he had applied himself to some habitual strain of the fervent energy which, when roused, was so passionately roused within him. I had it in my thoughts to remonstrate with him upon his desperate way of pursuing any fancy that he took, such as this buffeting of rough seas and braving of hard weather, for example, when my mind glanced off to the immediate subject of our conversation again and pursued that instead. I tell you what, Steerforth, said I, if your high spirits will listen to me, they are potent spirits and will do whatever you like, he answered, moving from the table to the fireside again. Then I tell you what, Steerforth, I think I'll go down and see my old nurse. It's not that I can do her any good or render her any real service, but she's so attached to me that my visit will have as much effect on her as if I could do both. She'll take it so kindly that it'll be a comfort and support to her. It's no great effort to make, I'm sure, for such a friend as she's been to me. Wouldn't you go a day's journey if you were in my place? His face was thoughtful, and he sat considering a little before he answered in a low voice, "Well, go. You can do no harm." "You've just come back," said I, "and it would be in vain to ask you to go with me." "Quite," he returned. "I'm for Highgate tonight. I've not seen my mother this long time, and it lies upon my conscience, for it's something to be loved as she loves her prodigal son." "Bah, nonsense. You mean to go tomorrow, I suppose?" he said, holding me out at arm's length, with a hand on each of my shoulders. "Yes, I think so." "Well, then, don't go till next day. I wanted you to come and stay a few days with us. Here I am on purpose to bid you, and you fly off to Yarmouth. You're a nice fellow to talk of flying off, Steerforth, who are always running wild on some unknown expedition or other." He looked at me for a moment without speaking, and then rejoined, still holding me as before, and giving me a shake, "Come, say the next day, and pass as much of tomorrow as you can with us. Who knows when we may meet again else? Come, say the next day. I want you to stand between Rosa Dartle and me and keep us asunder." Would you love each other too much without me? Yes, or hate? Laughed Steerforth. No matter which. Come, say the next day. I said the next day. And he put on his greatcoat and lighted his cigar, and set off to walk home. Finding him in this intention, I put on my own greatcoat, but did not light my own cigar, having had enough of that for one while, and walked with him as far as the open road. A dull road, then, at night. He was in great spirits all the way, and when we parted, and I looked after him going so gallantly and airily homeward, I thought of his saying, "Ride on over all obstacles and win the race," and wished, for the first time, that he had some worthy race to run. I was undressing in my own room when Mr. Micawber's letter tumbled on the floor. Thus reminded of it, I broke the seal and read as follows. It was dated an hour and a half before dinner. I'm not sure whether I've mentioned that when Mr. Micawber was at any particularly desperate crisis, he used a sort of legal phraseology, which he seemed to think equivalent to winding up his affairs. Sir, for I dare not say, my dear Copperfield, it is expedient that I should inform you that the undersigned is crushed. Some flickering efforts to spare you the premature knowledge of his calamitous position you may observe in him this day, but hope has sunk beneath the horizon and the undersigned is crushed. The present communication is penned within the personal range, I cannot call it the society, of an individual in a state closely bordering on intoxication employed by a broker. That individual is in legal possession of the premises under a distress for rent. His inventory includes not only the chattels and effects of every description belonging to the undersigned as yearly tenant of this habitation, but also those appertaining to Mr. Thomas Traddles, lodger, a member of the Honourable Society of the Inner Temple. If any drop of gloom were wanting in the overflowing cup, which is now commended, in the language of an immortal writer, to the lips of the undersigned, it would be found in the fact that a friendly acceptance granted to the undersigned by the before-mentioned Mr. Thomas Traddles for the sum of £23.04.09 halfpenny is overdue and is not provided for. Also in the fact that the living responsibilities clinging to the undersigned will, in the course of nature, be increased by the sum of one more helpless victim, whose miserable appearance may be looked for, in round numbers, at the expiration of a period not exceeding 6 lunar months from the present date. After premising thus much, it would be a work of supererogation to add that dust and ashes are forever scattered on the head of Wilkins Micawber. Poor Traddles. I knew enough of Mr. Micawber by this time to foresee that he might be expected to recover the blow, but my night's rest was sorely distressed by thoughts of Traddles and of the curate's daughter, who was 1 of 10 down in Devonshire, and who was such a dear girl, and who would wait for Traddles, ominous praise, until she was 60, or any age that could be mentioned. Chapter 29. I visit Steerforth at his home again. I mentioned to Mr. Spenlow in the morning that I wanted leave of absence for a short time, and as I wasn't in the receipt of any salary, and consequently was not obnoxious to the implacable Jawkins, there was no difficulty about it. I took that opportunity, with my voice sticking in my throat, and my sight failing as I uttered the words, to express my hope that Miss Spenlow was quite well, to which Mr. Spenlow replied, with no more emotion than if he'd been speaking of an ordinary human being, that he was much obliged to me, and she was very well. We articled clerks, as germs of the patrician order of proctors, were treated with so much consideration that I was almost my own master at all times. As I didn't care, however, to get to Highgate before 1 or 2 o'clock in the day, and as we had another little excommunication case in court that morning, which was called the Office of the Judge, promoted by Tipkins against Bullock for his soul's correction, I passed an hour or two in attendance on it with Mr. Spenlow very agreeably. It arose out of a scuffle between two church wardens, one of whom was alleged to have pushed the other against a pump, the handle of which pump projecting into a schoolhouse, which schoolhouse was under the gable of the church roof, made the push an ecclesiastical offence. It was an amusing case, and sent me up to Highgate on the box of the stagecoach, thinking about the Commons, and what Mr. Spenlow had said about touching the Commons and bringing down the country. Mrs. Steerforth was pleased to see me, and so was Rosa Dartle. I was agreeably surprised to find that Littimer was not there, and that we were attended by a modest little parlour-maid, with blue ribbons in her cap, whose eye it was much more pleasant, and much less disconcerting to catch by accident, than the eye of that respectable man. But what I particularly observed before I'd been half an hour in the house was the close and attentive watch Miss Dartle kept upon me, and the lurking manner in which she seemed to compare my face with Steerforth's, and Steerforth's with mine, and to lie in wait for something to come out between the two. So surely as I looked towards her did I see that eager visage, with its gaunt black eyes and searching brow, intent on mine, or passing suddenly from mine to Steerforth's, or comprehending both of us at once. In this lynx-like scrutiny, she was so far from faltering when she saw I observed it, that at such a time she only fixed her piercing look upon me with a more intent expression still. Blameless as I was, and knew that I was in reference to any wrong she could possibly suspect me of, I shrunk before her strange eyes, quite unable to endure their hungry lustre. All day she seemed to pervade the whole house. If I talked to Steerforth in his room, I heard her dress rustle in the little gallery outside. When he and I engaged in some of our old exercises on the lawn behind the house, I saw her face pass from window to window, like a wandering light, until it fixed itself in one and watched us. When we all four went out walking in the afternoon, she closed her thin hand on my arm like a spring to keep me back, while Steerforth and his mother went on out of hearing, and then spoke to me. "You've been a long time," she said, "without coming here. Is your profession really so engaging and interesting as to absorb your whole attention? I ask because I always want to be informed when I'm ignorant. Is it really, though?" I replied that I liked it well enough, but that I certainly couldn't claim so much for it. "Oh, I am glad to know that, because I always like to be put right when I'm wrong," said Rosa Dartle. "You mean it's a little dry, perhaps?" "Well," I replied, "perhaps it was a little dry." "Oh, and that's a reason why you want relief and change, excitement and all that," said she. "Ah, very true. But isn't it a little, for him, I don't mean you." A quick glance of her eye towards the spot where Steerforth was walking, with his mother leaning on his arm, showed me whom she meant. But beyond that, I was quite lost, and I looked so, I have no doubt. I don't say that it does, mind, I want to know. Don't it rather engross him? Don't it make him perhaps a little more remiss than usual in his visits to his blindly doting... With another quick glance at them, and such a glance at me, as seemed to look into my innermost thoughts. "Miss Dartle," I returned, "pray do not think..." "I don't," she said. "Oh, dear me, don't suppose that I think anything. I'm not suspicious. I only ask a question. I don't state any opinion. I want to found an opinion on what you tell me. Then it's not so. Well, I'm very glad to know it." "It certainly is not the fact," said I, perplexed, "that I am accountable for Steerforth's having been away from home longer than usual. If he has been, which I really don't know at this moment, unless I understand it from you, I've not seen him this long while until last night." "No. Indeed, Miss Dartle, no." As she looked full at me, I saw her face grow sharper and paler, and the marks of the old wound lengthen out until it cut through the disfigured lip and deep into the nether lip, and slanted down the face. There was something positively awful to me in this, and in the brightness of her eyes as she said, looking fixedly at me, "What is he doing?" I repeated the words more to myself than her, being so amazed. "What is he doing?" she said, with an eagerness that seemed enough to consume her like a fire. "In what is that man assisting him, who never looks at me without an inscrutable falsehood in his eyes? If you are honourable and faithful, I don't ask you to betray your friend. I ask you only to tell me, is it anger? Is it hatred? Is it pride? Is it restlessness? Is it some wild fancy? Is it love? What is it that is leading him?" "Miss Dartle," I returned, "how shall I tell you so that you will believe me that I know of nothing in Steerforth different from what there was when I first came here? I can think of nothing. I firmly believe there is nothing. I hardly understand even what you mean." As she still looked fixedly at me, a twitching or throbbing from which I could not dissociate the idea of pain came into that cruel mark and lifted up the corner of her lip as if with scorn, or with a pity that despised its object. She put a hand upon it hurriedly, a hand so thin and delicate that when I had seen her hold it up before the fire to shade her face, I had compared it in my thoughts to fine porcelain, and saying in a quick, fierce, passionate way, "I swear you to secrecy about this," said not a word more. Mrs. Steerforth was particularly happy in her son's society, and Steerforth was, on this occasion, particularly attentive and respectful to her. It was very interesting to me to see them together, not only on account of their mutual affection, but because of the strong personal resemblance between them, and the manner in which what was haughty or impetuous in him was softened by age and sex in her to a gracious dignity. I thought more than once that it was well no serious cause of division had ever come between them, or two such natures, I ought rather to express it, two such shades of the same nature, might have been harder to reconcile than the two extremest opposites in creation. The idea didn't originate in my own discernment, I'm bound to confess, but in a speech of Rosa Dartle's. She said at dinner, "Oh, but do tell me there's somebody, because I've been thinking about it all day, and I want to know." "You want to know what, Rosa?" returned Mrs. Steerforth. "Pray, pray, Rosa, do not be mysterious." "Mysterious?" she cried. "Oh, really, do you consider me so?" "I constantly entreat you," said Mrs. Steerforth, "to speak plainly in your own natural manner." "Oh, then this is not my natural manner," she rejoined. "Now you must really bear with me, because I ask for information. We never know ourselves." "It has become a second nature," said Mrs. Steerforth, without any displeasure. "But I remember, and so must you, I think, when your manner was different, Rosa, when it was not so guarded and was more trustful." "I'm sure you're right," she returned, "and so it is that bad habits grow upon one." "Really? Less guarded and more trustful? How can I imperceptibly have changed, I wonder?" "Well, that's very odd. I must study to regain my former self." "I wish you would," said Mrs. Steerforth with a smile. "Oh, I really will, you know," she answered. "I will learn frankness from, let me see, from James." "You cannot learn frankness, Rosa," said Mrs. Steerforth quickly, for there was always some effect of sarcasm in what Rosa Dartle said, though it was said, as this was, in the most unconscious manner in the world, "in a better school." "That I'm sure of," she answered, with uncommon fervour. "If I'm sure of anything, of course, you know, I'm sure of that." Mrs. Steerforth appeared to me to regret having been a little nettled, for she presently said in a kind tone, "Well, my dear Rosa, we've not heard what it is that you want to be satisfied about." "That I want to be satisfied about?" she replied with provoking coldness. "Oh, it was only whether people who are like each other in their moral constitution—is that the phrase?" "It's as good a phrase as another," said Steerforth. Thank you. Whether people who are like each other in their moral constitution are in greater danger than people not so circumstanced, supposing any serious cause of variance to arise between them, of being divided angrily and deeply? I should say yes, said Steerforth. Should you? She retorted. Dear me. Supposing then, for instance, any unlikely thing will do for a supposition, that you and your mother were to have a serious quarrel. My dear Rosa, interposed Mrs. Steerforth, laughing good-naturedly, suggest some other supposition. James and I know our duty to each other better, I pray heaven. Oh, said Miss Dartle, nodding her head thoughtfully, to be sure. That would prevent it. Why, of course it would. Exactly. Now I'm glad I've been so foolish as to put the case, for it is so very good to know that your duty to each other would prevent it. Thank you very much. One other little circumstance connected with Miss Dartle I must not omit, for I had reason to remember it thereafter, when all the irremediable past was rendered plain. During the whole of this day, but especially from this period of it, Steerforth exerted himself with his utmost skill, and that was with his utmost ease, to charm this singular creature into a pleasant and pleased companion. That he should succeed was no matter of surprise to me. That she should struggle against the fascinating influence of his delightful art, delightful nature, I thought it then, did not surprise me either, for I knew that she was sometimes jaundiced and perverse. I saw her features and her manner slowly change. I saw her look at him with growing admiration. I saw her try more and more faintly, but always angrily, as if she condemned a weakness in herself, to resist the captivating power that he possessed. And finally I saw her sharp glance soften, and her smile become quite gentle, and I ceased to be afraid of her, as I had really been all day. And we all sat about the fire, talking and laughing together, with as little reserve as if we'd been children. Whether it was because we'd sat there so long, or because Steerforth was resolved not to lose the advantage he gained, I don't know. But we didn't remain in the dining room more than 5 minutes after her departure. "She's playing her harp," said Steerforth softly at the drawing-room door. "And nobody but my mother has heard her do that, I believe, these 3 years." He said it with a curious smile, which was gone directly, and we went into the room and found her alone. "Don't get up," said Steerforth, which she'd already done. "My dear Rosa, don't. Be kind for once and sing us an Irish song." "What do you care for an Irish song?" she returned. "Much," said Steerforth. "Much more than for any other. Here's Daisy, too, loves music from his soul. Sing us an Irish song, Rosa, and let me sit and listen as I used to do." He didn't touch her or the chair from which she'd risen, but sat himself near the harp. She stood beside it for some little while in a curious way, going through the motion of playing it with her right hand, but not sounding it. At length, she sat down and drew it to her with one sudden action, and played and sang. I don't know what it was in her touch or voice that made that song the most unearthly I have ever heard in my life, or can imagine. There was something fearful in the reality of it. It was as if it had never been written or set to music, but sprung out of the passion within her, which found imperfect utterance in the low sounds of her voice, and crouched again when all was still. I was dumb when she leant beside the harp again, playing it, but not sounding it with her right hand. A minute more, and this had roused me from my trance. Steerforth had left his seat and gone to her, and had put his arm laughingly about her and had said, "Come, Rosa, for the future we will love each other very much." And she had struck him, and had thrown him off with the fury of a wild cat, and had burst out of the room. "What's the matter with Rosa?" said Mrs. Steerforth, coming in. "She's been an angel, mother," returned Steerforth for a little while, "and has run into the opposite extreme since, by way of compensation. You should be careful not to irritate her, James. Her temper has been soured, remember, and ought not to be tried. Rosa did not come back, and no other mention was made of her, until I went with Steerforth into his room to say good night. Then he laughed about her, but asked me if I had ever seen such a fierce little piece of incomprehensibility. I expressed as much of my astonishment as was then capable of expression, and asked if he could guess what it was that she had taken so much amiss so suddenly. "Oh, heaven knows," said Steerforth, "anything like, or nothing. I told you she took everything, herself included, to a grindstone and sharpened it. She's an edge tool and requires great care in dealing with. She's always dangerous." "Good night." "Good night," said I, "my dear Steerforth. I shall be gone before you wake in the morning. Good night." He was unwilling to let me go and stood holding me out with a hand on each of my shoulders as he had done in my own room. "Daisy," he said with a smile, "for though that's not the name your godfathers and godmothers gave you, it's the name I like best to call you by, and I wish you could give it to me." "Why, so I can if I choose," said I. "Daisy, if anything should ever separate us, you must think of me at my best, old boy. Come, let's make that bargain. Think of me at my best if circumstances should ever part us." "You have no best to me, Steerforth," said I, "and no worst. You are always equally loved and cherished in my heart." So much compunction for having ever wronged him, even by a shapeless thought, did I feel within me that the confession of having done so was rising to my lips. But for the reluctance I had to betray the confidence of Agnes, but for my uncertainty how to approach the subject with no risk of doing so, it would have reached them before he said, "God bless you, Daisy, and good night." In my doubt it did not reach them, and we shook hands and we parted. I was up with the dull dawn, and having dressed as quietly as I could, looked into his room. He was fast asleep, lying easily with his head upon his arm, as I had often seen him lie at school. The time came in its season, and that was very soon, when I almost wondered that nothing troubled his repose as I looked at him. But he slept, let me think of him so again, as I had so often seen him sleep at school, and thus, in this silent hour, I left him. Nevermore, oh God forgive you, Steerforth, to touch that passive hand in love and friendship. Never, never more. Chapter 30. A Loss. I got down to Yarmouth in the evening and went to the inn. I knew that Peggotty's spare room, my room, was likely to have occupation enough in a little while if that great visitor, before whose presence all the living must give place, were not already in the house. So I betook myself to the inn, and dined there and engaged my bed. It was 10 o'clock when I went out. Many of the shops were shut and the town was dull. When I came to Omer and Joram's, I found the shutters up, but the shop door standing open. As I could obtain a perspective view of Mr. Omer inside, smoking his pipe by the parlour door, I entered and asked him how he was.
"Why, bless my life and soul," said Mr. Omer, "how do you find yourself? Take a seat. Smoke not disagreeable, I hope."
"By no means," said I. "I like it in somebody else's pipe."
"Why, not in your own, eh?" Mr. Omer returned, laughing. "All the better, sir. Bad habit for a young man. Take a seat. I smoke myself for the asthma."
Mr. Omer had made room for me and placed a chair. He now sat down again, very much out of breath, gasping at his pipe as if it contained a supply of that necessary without which he must perish. "I'm sorry to have heard bad news of Mr. Barkis," said I. Mr. Omer looked at me with a steady countenance and shook his head. "Do you know how he is tonight?" I asked.
"The very question I should have put to you, sir,"
returned Mr. Omer, "but
on account of delicacy,
That's one of the drawbacks of our line of business. When a party's ill, we can't ask how the party is. The difficulty hadn't occurred to me, though I'd had my apprehensions too when I went in of hearing the old tune. On its being mentioned, I recognised it, however, and said as much. Yes, yes, you understand, said Mr. Omer, nodding his head. We dursn't do it. Bless you, it would be a shock that the generality of parties mightn't recover to say Omer and Joram's compliments and how do you find yourself this morning, or this afternoon, as it may be. Mr. Omer and I nodded at each other, and Mr. Omer recruited his wind by the aid of his pipe. It's one of the things that cut the trade off from attentions they could often wish to show, said Mr. Omer. Take myself. If I have known Barkis a year to move to as he went by, I've known him 40 years. But I can't go and say how is he. I felt it was rather hard on Mr. Omer, and I told him so. I'm not more self-interested, I hope, than another man, said Mr. Omer. Look at me. My wind may fail me at any moment, and it ain't likely, to my own knowledge, I'd be self-interested under such circumstances. I say it ain't likely in a man who knows his wind'll go when it does go, as if a pair of bellows was cut open. And that man a grandfather, said Mr. Omer. I said, not at all. It ain't that I complain of my line of business, said Mr. Omer. It ain't that. Some good and some bad goes, no doubt, to all callings. What I wish is that parties were brought up stronger-minded. Mr. Omer, with a very complacent and amiable face, took several puffs in silence, and then said, resuming his first point, accordingly, we're obliged in ascertaining how Barkis goes on to limit ourselves to Emily. She knows what our real objects are, and she don't have any more alarms or suspicions about us than if we was so many lambs. Minnie and Joram have just stepped down to the house, in fact. She's there after hours helping her aunt a bit to ask her how he is tonight, and if you was to please to wait till they come back, they'd give you full particulars. Will you take something? A glass of shrub and water now. I smoke on shrub and water myself, said Mr. Omer, taking up his glass, because it's considered softening to the passages by which this troublesome breath of mine gets into action. But, Lord bless you, said Mr. Omer huskily, it ain't the passages as out of order. Give me breath enough, says I to my daughter Minnie, and I'll find passages, my dear. He really had no breath to spare, and it was very alarming to see him laugh. When he was again in a condition to be talked to, I thanked him for the proffered refreshment, which I declined as I'd just had dinner, and observing that I would wait, since he was so good as to invite me, until his daughter and his son-in-law came back, I inquired how little Emily was. Well, sir, said Mr. Omer, removing his pipe that he might rub his chin, I tell you truly, I shall be glad when her marriage has taken place. Why so? I inquired. Well, she's unsettled at present, said Mr. Omer. It ain't that she's not as pretty as ever, for she's prettier. I do assure you she is prettier. It ain't that she don't work as well as ever, for she does. She was worth any six, and she is worth any six. But somehow, she wants heart. If you understand, said Mr. Omer, after rubbing his chin again and thinking a little, what I mean in a general way by the expression, a long pull and a strong pull, and a pull altogether, my heart is hurrah. I should say to you that that was, in a general way, what I miss in Emily. Mr. Omer's face and manner went for so much that I could conscientiously nod my head as divining his meaning. My quickness of apprehension seemed to please him, and he went on, now, I consider this is principally on account of her being in an unsettled state, you see. We've talked it over a good deal, her uncle and myself, and her sweetheart and myself, after business, and I consider it's principally on account of her being unsettled. You must always recollect, Miss Emily, said Mr. Omer, shaking his head gently, that she's a most extraordinary affectionate little thing. The proverb says you can't make a silk purse out of a sow's ear. Well, I don't know about that. I rather think you may if you begin early in life. She's made a home out of that old boat, sir, that stone and marble couldn't beat. I'm sure.